Well, you're listening to Divine Mercy Radio. We call this program Treasures of Faith. I am your host, Bill Gent. It's always my pleasure and privilege to be behind this microphone sharing this time with you. And I've got I think an amazing and very interesting guest today, Jason Poblet. He is the president of and co-founder of Global Liberty Alliance, and he's an attorney, and he practices international and national security law. And so, Jason, welcome to Treasures of Faith. Thanks for dropping in.
Bill, thanks for having us. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Jason, this is such an interesting topic. I've really been looking forward to spending this time with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I assume you're a Catholic, but tell us a little bit about your upbringing and what led you to the law, let alone to Global Liberty Alliance.
How much time do we have? I'll summarize.
We got
it.
An hour.
You know, giving a lawyer a microphone and
it's almost like giving a Baptist preacher.
I'm not billing, but anyhow. No, seriously, though. Thanks for having us, and thank you for the work you all do to spread the good word here on the Space Coast and the Treasure Coast, where we sorely need it, and everywhere in the country right now.
Yes,
I was born and raised in Miami. My family came from Cuba after the communist takeover, and in the 90s, I kind of went to live in the greater D.C. metro area. I'm skipping ahead on a few things, but then I came back. Then I came back to the Space Coast a few years ago to Florida to be closer to family, and decided to set up here instead of Miami. Mm-hmm. That's another conversation. Mm-hmm. But my faith has always been a central part of the work we do, although as any Catholic, I mean, we'll continue to work on that. Faith is a lifelong journey, but it is part of our works. It is part of the what we call now that apostolate, which has become the Global Liberty Alliance, and we look forward to sharing more about it with you.
Well, it began, I understand, in 2016,
mm-hmm.
and tell us a little bit about how that all came about. I mean, you obviously, by the way, I just want to just pause for a moment. Do you have any connections still back in Cuba? Any family connections at all?
That I know of, no. Most people that I knew that were there left. And that's a topic that's interesting. In fact, the Catholic Church in Cuba remains probably the one institution that is trying to bring that part of the healing process, because the families, as you know, were targeted by the socialists when they took over.
Absolutely.
And it created a lot of problems with it, even within families. And that's part of a longer conversation about how do you come out of a period of prolonged conflict where the family was pretty much weaponized.
Yeah.
And it's good that we have the Catholic Church down there, but most of my family, we didn't talk to anyone down there.
It's funny because Jesus even talked about the fact that family members would turn on one another. And this is an example for certain. And as we know, Cuba is kind of off the front pages now. You know, I mean, no one's really talking about Cuba at this point. So, Jason, so you grew up, obviously, you practiced your faith as a young person, I would expect. And what led you to the law?
Well, I went to Catholic school, by the way. So I went to St. Michael's, the Archangels, in Miami. Mm. And then I went to St. Brendan High before. So it was part of my faith. I'll share a little bit about that background. And then after high school, I kind of fell away from the faith a little bit. I mean, it was a
pretty normal.
Wasn't a huge break, but it was somewhat of a break. Mm-hmm. And after college, I went to Georgetown before I went to law school. I did a master's at Georgetown. And talk about a reawakening. I was there when Georgetown University was removing crucifixes from the classroom.
I remember that.
That was during the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to offend, well, who knows why they did it. But that started my journey back, especially my wife of almost 30 years now, Elem. Mm. She's the one who slowly nudged me back. And it was real neat. In fact, she had an interesting faith journey also. She also started doing her degree work at Georgetown, but because of what happened, she transferred out to Catholic University. That's where she finished her PhD. Mm. So anyhow, so that faith journey has always been a central part of what we did, except for that huge gap after college. And really the one person who I think inspired me to go into the law was my grandfather. who was a lawyer in Cuba. And unfortunately, he could not practice law after he left because the U.S. Except if he moved to Louisiana, which he didn't want to do under the civil system. So he decided not to do that. But he always taught us through action that the law can be, in a free society, the law can be a good equalizer, a good source of justice. I'm afraid in this country right now, we're having a huge problem with rule of law and accountability.
Yes, we are.
But it was him. It was my grandfather, Gonzalo.
You know what's interesting? I don't want to interrupt you here, but I'm thinking about your grandfather.
Mm.
He's practicing the law in Cuba.
Mm.
He comes here to experience freedom,
mm-hmm.
and he's no longer able to practice his craft.
Correct.
I mean, that must have been a real struggle for him.
My grandfather, I get goosebumps talking about this, but until the day he died, and I was with him, I shared that end-of-life journey with him. Mm-hmm. I was blessed to spend a lot of time with him at the very end. We talked a lot about this.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather never one day complained about anything.
Mm-hmm.
He loved this country. He spent time, two jobs when he got here. He was waiting tables at night, and he was selling shoes during the daytime at a store called Burdine's. I don't think Burdine's exists anymore, but I think folks who are South Florida would know that company. And that's what he was doing. And he never complained one day. He said, look, I'm free. I was able to get my family out. Mm. He was the last one to get out of Cuba. He had to coordinate his family, get them all out. And the government wouldn't let him leave either. They kept trying again to stay.
Mm-hmm.
But he was never with the system. He too was Catholic.
Mm.
But a very private man when it came to faith. He was old school. He never, he led through action. He didn't lead through telling you to do anything. In fact, it was only toward the end of his life that we had a lot of deep conversations about faith.
You know, I think we underestimate, and I'm sure you're appreciative of this, how much he was an inspiration to you. You know, with all that he sacrificed, and he sacrificed to experience freedom, and now you are working, you've devoted your life to promoting freedom in other places around the world. I just think there's something special, certainly, about your grandfather, and I know you would agree.
You know, he again, there's a few things that he probably, he never said, but I'm pretty sure he was not happy about. He never liked politics, but I love politics.
Mm-hmm.
But he came to understand over time, and you can understand that, right? I mean, he came from a country where they used politics. When the communists took over in 59, that was the end. It started in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
So communism didn't just show up.
That's right.
It crept in.
It did.
And that's kind of what happens in almost every society.
Yes.
It's happening here. And he just felt that mixing those two were problematic. But the law, he always felt, again, in a free society, can help rectify things so long as there are good people with a moral core.
Mm-hmm.
He always believed that you had to have a moral core, a belief system bigger than yourself.
That's right.
Humbling yourself and knowing that you have to answer to a higher authority.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he never, ever talked about religion that way. Mm. But that's the way I see it, the way he lived his life. So the law for us, for me, had always been a potential way to do some of the work that we... Remember, I grew up in a Miami that was during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
So my friends in the political world were doing maybe other type of activities. I was surrounded by former Contras, came from Nicaragua, from medical care in Miami.
Sure.
I was surrounded by political prisoners going on hunger strikes. In fact, on my 15th birthday, I remember vividly, my father says, hey, I'm going to go show you something. And he took me, this is my dad, and he took us to a hunger strike of 20, 30 people, I forget how many, in Little Havana, who were protesting something Cuba was up to, doing something to a political prisoner over there. And stuck with me because he saw these men and women under these tarps, these blue tarps, in the heat with IVs to hydrate, not eating. And they were putting their bodies to use as an instrument of protest. That stuck with me. I said, wow, these people are going to go all the way out. So I grew up with
that. You don't see that every day.
You don't see it every day. And when you grew up with that, it has an impact. I thought, you know what? The law is, my grandfather and my dad, they never told me what you had to be a lawyer. I found my way to the law because I felt that that was an instrument that could be used for good.
God was working in your life, preparing you for what you do now. You know, that has a way of kind of reaffirming to you as you move forward, Jason, that you're doing what God intended for you to do.
Bill, if that's what he wants me to do, in fact, that's a good story about GLA and how GLA came about. I'll do it. When GLA started, we never imagined we would turn into a hostage advocacy or fundamental rights, because you know that's our mission. We defend fundamental rights, free enterprise, and rule of law. When you have those three in a free society, fundamental rights, of course, are God-given rights. Things tend to go on a better path. That's what I've seen, whether if I've traveled to some interesting places around the world and seen this, or whether I've lived it here. You have defense of fundamental rights, free enterprise, and rule of law, good things will follow. And the organization, when we started it, again, we said, okay, let's try and get this hostage out of Iran. And we thought this would take 6-7 months.
Sure.
It took us 4 years.
Wow.
And then it led to another one. Then we took another one, and with the help of the U.S. government, of course. Two Americans came out of Iran. And then we started receiving cases from other countries, Venezuela, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Lebanon, and China, of course. We'll talk a little bit about that one in a minute, because that's an interesting Catholic connection. And we felt that, well, if this is what God wants us to do, we'll just keep doing it until we have either a capacity problem, or we decide, hey, the resources will come. If God wants us to do this, it'll happen.
On GLA's website, Jason, under mission, what really struck me was a quote from John Adams. We all know who John Adams was, right? He was our second president, right? He once said, and this is a quote, "There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide."
That's correct.
You know, I mean, read that and I thought to myself, that is absolutely correct.
That's right.
You know, and of course, we all know that all of this goes back to the garden, right? Amen. To the Garden of Eden, you know, where we decided, not we, but, you know, in Adam, we decided we want it our way. We don't want it God's way. And you just alluded to the idea of a moral foundation. You know, for any good law, you have to have a moral foundation, something your grandfather certainly understood. But it's very confusing today. And I think when you look at, and you kind of, again, alluded to it in this country, not everyone thinks today that we are truly focused on the rule of law, that, you know, and we were established as a republic, but it seems as if we don't talk about that anymore. We've kind of slid into this kind of democracy where truth is the opinion of the powerful, I guess you could say. And I know the work that you do, it's got to be extremely frustrating, because it's almost as if everyone keeps moving the goalposts, so to speak. And perhaps this is something that, that we can talk about. So getting involved with GLA, so you're the co-founder, obviously. Was it something, so you were part of a law firm, and then these kinds of cases kind of emerged, and you obviously, you probably have partners, I would think. You had to get together and decide whether you were going to go down this road.
Yeah, we did.
And that must have been a big decision, because what you're talking about is, as a law firm, I mean, you have the potential to do very well financially, right? And to, you know, kind of take care of self. But you guys made a very big decision to go down this road that, yeah, okay, we can live. But again, it's going to cost us. And that was quite a decision. Did your faith enter into that at all?
Wow, Bill, that's a an interesting question. I never thought about it that way. I can tell you that that was the second big, I would say, in the journey of our journey through Washington, through the halls of power of Washington. When we started the law firm, the law firm's still there. We're a national security law firm, does international law, international claims law. And that project started 15 years ago. I was at a big law firm. I had left Congress. I had worked there for almost 7 years, probably 5 years more than I wanted to. I never wanted to work in government.
I don't know if we want to go down that road.
I never, well, it was just something, it didn't appeal
to me. Experience, though.
It didn't appeal to me, but it was an experience.
Yes.
And it did teach me how there's some good,
yeah,
but there's also yeah. human nature and mm-hmm. nothing new. Mm-hmm. You can go back and crack open yep. the Federalist Papers, and you'll yep. read all about factions and whatever. Right. It's all there.
Madison was brilliant.
They were
really was.
So this stuff's
brilliant.
Not new.
Yeah.
But I was at a big law firm, and this is how the whole our journey started. I wanted these cases started showing up, and I was at a big D.C. law firm. I enjoyed the work; it was great. But I always wanted to keep working on these cases. I had always done something in the human rights space of some sort, either help a political prisoner. Follow the issue. Anyone who knows me knows we've always had that thread. Both, it's been in my family for a long time. So we decided, you know what? I'm going to leave this big law firm. And a partner, my business partner, Mauricio, he decided he was leaving government service. Now, he'd been in the government a long time. And he was over at DOJ. He worked in Congress for a while. We were all friends for a bit. And we decided one day, we were over at an Irish pub off Capitol Hill, and they said, hey, why don't we just start this law firm? Mm. And he looks at me and says, are you serious? I go, yeah. It's just, I didn't want to stay at the big law firm.
Yeah.
Partly because yeah. not anything they did, but this type of work at a big law firm can create conflicts.
Yes.
And yeah. I felt
and it gets political.
It can get political. So we felt, let's see if we can make a run of this thing. And luckily I had the support of my wife, Ilem, and he had the support of his wife, Tara. We launched into this thing and law firm's still going. This comes up. And perhaps maybe it was a sacrifice. I don't see it that way. I mean, maybe it is. It's the stuff that complements what we do, and I think we all have a duty with whatever we do in life. It doesn't have to be law. It could be anything.
Right.
The station, the labor of love.
Sure.
If you have a skill and he's asking you to use it for something, mm-hmm. you should try and do that. And any time I've resisted, by the way, that tug.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Doesn't work, does it?
It doesn't yeah. work. And the work kept coming. Mm-hmm. And it keeps coming.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, sometimes we have to turn people away. Mm-hmm. But if it's something that we can take on mm-hmm. and we can either advise on a case throughout the life of a case yeah. or help fellow lawyers, because again, we team up with lawyers in these countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not that we go in there and tell people what to
right.
do.
Right.
We team up with people that want to do that sort of work mm-hmm. in those places. Mm-hmm. Again, partly because we don't want them to become problems here.
Yep.
But when they impact Americans directly,
yeah.
how can we not?
How
so we team up with local council. So we find ways to make it work. And if he wants us to keep doing it, I'm pretty sure that we will keep doing it.
Well, you're listening to Treasures of Faith. I'm joined by Jason Poblet, and he's the president and co-founder of the Global Liberty Alliance. Jason, you just mentioned this because sometimes, and I think there are examples of this where we believe in this kind of American exceptionalism, you know, that, and let's face it, after World War II, we became a world power, mm-hmm. you know, only perhaps challenged by the Soviet Union. After the fall of the Soviet Union, we were the big man on campus, so to speak, mm-hmm. and we kind of dictated to the world what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And for good and for bad, I think in some ways, I think you said it right, because your experience in Congress, you know, I mean, Congress doesn't have a very good approval rating, as you know, most politicians don't, but there are some good people.
Yes, there are, mm-hmm.
you know, and they're trying to do their best, yeah. but it's a massive system. And large institutions always invite some form of corruption, as yeah. you know. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's good and bad. I mean, Jesus even talked about this,
he's
right?
Surrounded by
right?
it.
That's it, exactly. Yeah. So we shouldn't be surprised. What I think our listeners would be interested in, and you kind of mentioned it, is that in situations where people's freedom where they're being oppressed in some way, and of course specifically when there's an American involved, but you go into these countries, you don't dictate to them, look, we have our rule of law, you have yours, we don't care about your rule of law.
You can't do that, no.
You can't do that, you know, so you have to walk very carefully, but it must be very challenging to inform legal counsel in these other countries because they, in some instances, might be open to persecution themselves.
Wow. How do we unpack that? There's a few important statements you said there, comments you made there. I'll come back to the Congress in a minute. But I'll use the case of Cuba, for example. where we have worked with Cuban lawyers, independent lawyers on the ground in Cuba. So Cuba's legal system is run by the government. So it's not like in the U.S. where you have independent bars,
right,
and you can open, you know, open your own shingle and have your own law firm and move mm-hmm. on. No, everyone who wants to work as a lawyer in Cuba must work for the government. Mm. So when you're an American locked up illegally or not in Cuba, let's face it, not everybody gets locked up illegally or unlawfully.
Right.
Some people
right.
do get picked
right.
up for committing crimes.
Sure.
Probably don't want to commit crimes in a place like
no.
Cuba, but I mean, people.
We don't recommend.
No, you, I don't even recommend people go there, but,
yeah,
people, but people
right.
do. And,
yeah, they
and,
do.
And they could end up in legal hot water, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes they commit crimes. And
mm-hmm.
But some people are not. Some people are lured into situations
crimes,
because
yes.
there's political reasons for it.
Yeah.
And one of the most challenging parts of cases like these is having to bite your tongue, having to understand that the mission is not to tell the Cubans what to do.
Right. Right.
But it's also challenging because we have to, sometimes we work with independent lawyers outside the system mm. who are risking their lives.
Yes, I would imagine.
To defend Americans.
Really?
So there's an American in Cuba. Her name is Elena Lopez. She's a Florida resident. She's been locked up for almost 7 years. Now she's technically free, but she's now under a what they call a house arrest. But the lawyers that were helping us in Cuba were not the regime lawyers. They were lawyers who were independent, who we found through our network, and they said, we're going to help you. And one of them, unfortunately, just passed away. And he was a young man. He was in his 60s. And they will risk life and limb. Why? And you say about not telling the Cubans what to do about their laws. Because they felt that even under their system, as broken as they admit
yeah.
that system happens
yeah.
to be,
yeah.
these are proud men and women who believe in the law.
Yeah.
And they say, wait a minute, we're not supposed to lock this lady. And by this is fact.
Mm.
They were not supposed to lock her up. She's a civilian.
Mm.
She's an American.
Mm.
She was tried by a military court and locked up in a political prison and then sent to a labor camp for things that ab initio, at the very start of the process, she should have never been picked up for. It's a very complex case, but it gives you a flavor, though, where you have brave men and women, despite the danger of their lives.
Yeah.
They step up and said, no, we want to help you. And we find this in other places, in Iran. I found this in China. I have found this in just pretty much anywhere we have done work.
Mm.
And it's an interesting straddling because when I have to deal with the government,
yeah,
it's a totally different
yes.
way of communicating.
Sure.
But knowing you have people backing you up in those places, even
mm-hmm.
if they can't be public about it,
mm-hmm.
that inform us, hey, Jason,
mm-hmm.
tell them about this law. Tell
yeah.
them about that
yeah.
law, that they guide you through their legal system,
mm-hmm.
even though it's broken. It does have this effect on the governments that over time we have found working with the U.S. government and other stakeholders, you can work to get people out.
Yeah.
Unconditionally, by the way, without paying
mm-hmm.
a dime,
mm-hmm.
just so you know. But there's
it,
a debate about whether or not you should pay or not. But you can get people out from these places without paying ransom.
Okay.
Okay.
Is in some situations, it is really about that. I mean, because if, let's face it, there is no perfect form of justice in any country. I mean, ours may be the best in the world, would you suggest?
I say it's still the gold standard, but we have work to do.
We got work to do. It's being challenged.
Oh, yes.
no doubt, even as we speak.
Yes.
And we know this. And so we have to be careful, hopefully, to maintain that standard, but it'd be people like yourself, certainly. And I think people have to be better informed also and not allow things to deteriorate. You mentioned in Cuba, things began falling apart in the 20s,
right.
you know, before the revolution in the early 50s,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
So in this country, we're beginning to see it. We're, 20, 30 years in where things are beginning to kind of fall apart in our system. You know, I go back to the example you gave. Even in some of these countries, Jason, even people that are part of a system, in other words, an oppressive regime of one kind or another, they still have a conscience, right?
Hmm.
So for some of them, if they're in a legal system, they still sort of subtly understand that there is such a thing as truth or there is such a thing as genuine law. And so if you're able to appeal to that in some way, without getting personalities in the way and without, you know, walking into a courtroom and yelling and screaming like you see on TV. You know, I mean, it probably has a lot to do with your demeanor when you approach these people, rather than going in and being boisterous and sort of condescending or anything like that. Does that have any play in some of these situations?
I think that has a play in everything we do in life, how you treat your fellow man. And you know, if you follow the golden rule, even with your adversaries, when you have the truth on your side, it's kind of, it's almost an empowering shield that you carry with you. And when we meet with lawyers, for example, and we talk about, like in Cuba, for example, when we first did our first on-site, not in Cuba, in a third country training, usually people call them training in the aid world. I felt it was better to call it a workshop. I wasn't going to meet with fellow lawyers to train them in anything. Mm-hmm. These men and women are lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what we did, instead of telling them this is how you should do your human rights work, right, as most NGOs tend to do, because we started doing programming work outside the U.S., we decided, you know what? No, I'm not going to do that. We're going to go in there. We're going to share with them, this is how we do things in America. Mm-hmm. I want to hear about how you do things in Cuba. And then we'll talk about what can we do together to advance the cause of justice. We never once told them, this is how you must do a case. And I think that's kind of what we try and set ourselves apart from other groups that do this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We're not going to get into ideologies here, but there, most of these groups, and there's some great organizations in the U.S. That do this work also. But the people that approach it the way we do it, from a faith-based perspective, are
totally different.
Few and far between, and very different an approach. And again, we're not there to tell these lawyers how to do their jobs. These men and women are trained. Mm-hmm. We know some of them have an ideological core that's different from our own. Mm-hmm. But our goal then, to get to your question, Bill, was to remove that tension that we knew was there, because they were used to people going and meeting with them and telling them how you will do your work. Mm-hmm. We said, no, I want to hear how they do their work. And I want them to share with us, how would you tackle something like this?
Yeah.
Eventually, we brought lawyers over here, and we'd take them to our courtrooms, we'd take them to Congress, expose them to our legal system, expose them to how people interact and deconflict. And the people are just amazed when they see this, because they wonder, wow, the police officer here can pull you over, but they need probable cause. Now, they know what probable cause is.
Sure.
But when they see it in action in the U.S., it's just pretty phenomenal. So I love to share that part of our country with people, because it's something that they don't see. If you lead by example, I think good things can happen.
Yeah, so. And I think that's great, you know, and that's why I would applaud your organization. Although I think well-informed Americans know that not all NGOs do good things. Some of them have nefarious motives. And, you know, of course, a lot of people don't even kind of choose to believe that. Jason, I mean, have you personally visit some of these countries in your work? I mean, on a regular basis, or, I mean, how is it dangerous for you in some respects to go to these places?
Yeah. Most of the time when we do that sort of thing, it's a third country visit, or believe it or not, you could do a lot of that here in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. There are some countries that I cannot visit.
Okay.
And the U.S. government tells me not to.
Okay. Yeah.
Lest I end up.
Do sometimes
ending up in the same predicament, but there are ways to
do their legal people, do they sometimes grant, you know, visas to go to places like Washington, D.C. from some of these countries? Is it possible for that to?
We usually deal with diplomats. We rarely, if ever, will deal with the lawyers.
Right.
The lawyers
right.
in places like Cuba and Iran are there as figureheads. Mm-hmm. So they are not there to advocate the law. They're there to serve a role. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're working on a case now, for example, in Iran, where a man from California who the Iranians tried to assassinate in 2009 in California was picked up in 2020. And Mr. Sharmad, Jimmy Sharmad, was an opposition-type person. He lived in California. Mm-hmm. On a trip back home, he was kidnapped. He didn't go to Iran. He was in India on his way home through the UAE. Got picked up, locked up in Iran. Mm-hmm. We can't talk to the lawyers in Iran, but we do talk to certain people. Who can make things happen? I'll tell you. I'll share some more with that later.
Well, we're going to take a short break. Jason Poblet is with me. He's the president and co-founder of Global Liberty Alliance. Fascinating conversation. Stay with us. We'll be back in a few moments. You're listening to Divine Mercy Radio, Melbourne, Vero Beach. Well, welcome back to Treasures of Faith. I'm joined by Jason Poblet. And again, as I mentioned, he's the president and co-founder of Global Liberty Alliance. And these guys do great work in the area of international and national security law. Jason, we want to talk about some individual cases that you've actually been involved in. Let me ask you, do you have any idea how many Americans are actually falsely imprisoned in some of these other countries around the world?
Bill, that's a great question. And before we give you the number, I want to differentiate between there's really two types of cases. There are the run-of-the-mill, and they're not run-of-the-mill, but they are more frequent cases where you have a non-state actor, so a terrorist group. A good example of that, what's happening now with Hamas in Israel.
Yes.
Okay, that's a non-state actor. Mm-hmm. That is a terrorist organization backed by Iran, a proxy power. Then you have the cases we've been talking about, which are hostage, unlawful detention cases. There's a debate in the legal community about should they be called hostages or not. That are held by states, Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, North Korea. So I'll give you some Nicaragua. See, Nicaragua was holding a bunch of priests hostage, in my opinion, a few months ago. And
we have a priest here in the Diocese of Orlando who escaped all that and is...
So he's a good example. He's a good example of a hostage case held by the government. So we're talking about that first, the second bucket now about people held by state actors. According to the U.S. government, if you believe the data, and we think it's a low number, it's roughly 60 plus, maybe 66. If you, there's another organization that has been tracking these, and the number is much higher than that. Mm. It's not something we like to advertise. I don't think it's a good idea to talk too much about it, but the number's too high. Any American held for unlawful detention reasons or hostage reasons is something that we've left somebody behind. Americans, the first duty of the U.S. government is to take care of their nationals, border security. Yes, when you travel, you run a risk.
Yes.
I understand that. And by the way, anybody listening to me, it's pretty safe to travel anywhere in the world, but seasoned travelers know that you have to do your due diligence.
Yes.
You have to do your homework. You got to prepare. You don't usually think about this sort of thing until it happens. That's a long conversation we have with families when they come see us. But it can't happen. You have a legal problem here. You can have a legal problem anywhere. But when you go to countries like Cuba, North Korea, Russia, China, it's a different type of travel.
Yeah.
And you run the risk of being locked up. Statistically, the odds are higher in those places, but it's still small. It's not huge, it's small. But it happens, and it's wrong, and you should never leave any American in that jam. And that's what these organizations, and we're seeing a spike in this. Back during the 70s and 80s, you all may remember the Iran hostage crisis from that was a big one, but there were also plane hijackings. There was all sort of state, non-state activities happening back then that led to the passing of this convention called the International Convention Against Taking of Hostages of 1979. It was a treaty. We're a party to it. So there is a body of law there. And then, but then the cases started waning a little bit. We had strong leadership. We would follow these hostage takers no matter where we were. We made sure it was unacceptable to do that sort of thing. There were accountability measures taken by the U.S. government. We believe the U.S. government should use all instruments of state power, everything, from diplomacy and military force, to protect Americans no matter where they may be. For some reason, in the 90s and early 2000s, that kind of died down a bit, but now it's starting again. And you're seeing increases, by the way, in both camps, not just the state actors, but the non-state actors. So it's a high number. One is too many. But the best that we could tell, Bill, from the U.S. government record, it's about 60, roughly. But there are more than that.
Let me ask you this before we get into specific cases, Jason. But international law. So if you if you begin to talk about international law, you're looking at people, they look like a tree full of owls, you know. What are you talking about? Is international law, I mean, do you have any idea how long it's actually existed or what it's actually based upon? Is it based upon our system of law, or is it just kind of a conglomeration of everybody's sort of view of what justice is really all about?
Everything you just said. Yes, is everything you just said. I mean, even in the legal world, there's a lot of debate amongst lawyers about what should or should not be considered binding international law. I take a more traditional approach, conservative approach, in that there is customary international law that pretty, in the vernacular, it's just nations doing certain things over and over again that have worked mm-hmm. and that have been accepted as legal doctrine mm. and that they will continue to do and respect because it creates comedy, it creates, it's respectful of commerce. There's a lot that bundles up in there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of law of the sea can be considered international law. Outer space law can be considered mm. international law.
Which is going to impact Brevard County in Florida.
It does. Yeah. It already impacts Brevard County.
I can see that going forward.
The Artemis Accords are a great example mm. of, I guess you can argue, international law. But it's not a treaty. So that's a political. The Artemis Accords are a political agreement. I think under the U.S. system, which is the system I think we should be structuring what international laws we will or will not be a party to, those that are not customary international law that have become accepted legal doctrine, international commerce and comedy, are treaties, for example, that are approved by the Senate. Our founding fathers dealt with this. I mean, yes. and they gave us a mechanism to deal with it. And we have the Senate that will ratify or not treaties. And they're debated and they're not debated. Mm-hmm. I believe, frankly, the international rules-based system, like the United Nations, the Organization of American States to a lesser extent, all of that needs to be redone and rethought yeah. because yeah. it undermines U.S. sovereignty. Mm-hmm. It undermines, they do things and they sneak things into our regulatory system mm-hmm. that never, ever sees the light of day in Congress.
Really?
And when mm-hmm. American taxpayers expect the laws to be reviewed by Congress, and they are not because they somehow sneak into our regulatory yeah. system to the executive branch, that's a problem. And it's creating a lot of problems in trade and commerce. And I believe even in immigration, where you have items that are not even law sneaking into our legal system, used as legal argument to get people who are not even Americans out of our legal system. So, I mean, we don't have time to get into all of it, but basically it's a mishmash of a lot of custom.
Yeah.
But I believe it's very simple. If it has not been approved by our Congress, mm-hmm. if it has not been put together in a treaty that's been ratified under the U.S. system, we don't really have to pay attention to it. We could be respectful of it and see if it becomes customary international law over time. But unless it's a treaty, a binding treaty under the U.S. system, I don't think it's international law.
Does the United Nations, are they ever helpful at all as an organization to you? Not at all.
Absolutely not.
It appears that they have,
with one exception, though,
little power in reality.
Well, I guess you could, it's relative. It depends. I mean, we are the largest donor country to the UN.
Certainly.
Is there some utility? Maybe. It depends on what we think is useful or not in the international system. In some of these cases we are talking about, there is an entity, a UN entity out in Geneva called the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention that has a mechanism in place that is useful to lawyers and advocates to talk to the governments indirectly that are detaining Americans and U.S. nationals.
Kind of a go-between, I guess you could say.
Right, and they make findings based on record and testimony of whether or not there's an unlawful detention.
So it can be helpful from that perspective.
And by the way, I would love to have an organization that would work to resolve conflict, that would work to build peace. Mm-hmm. But that's not what the UN has become.
No.
The UN they had a vision for it back in the 40s, late 40s, that is not the system we have today. Mm-hmm. And I think we have the Americans some work to do to rein that in. But in this little space, this little sliver of work, there is a mechanism called that Working Group on Arbitrary Detention in Geneva where we can, through law, document and reach conclusions based on records. Because once we submit something to them, they go to the country that's holding the hostage. They ask them to respond, and there's this indirect dialogue happening. Then an independent body, I guess you can call them independent, will make a decision. Mm. And it's in writing, and it's public, and it can become sort of a rallying cry that we can use. I, of course, take those to Congress when we have those decisions, and we have a case in Texas, a case in China, of a family in Texas that we work with, where we had two congressional resolutions passed in support of Mark Sweden, an American who's been unlawfully imprisoned in communist China, a devout Catholic for over 11 years.
Wow. Tell us about, how he happened to become imprisoned in China. What's he doing there? let alone, and I understand Americans have been traveling to China now ever since Nixon opened the country.
Right.
I mean, I've known people that have spent years over there doing business, and yet there are some people that just fall into these situations where they find themselves imprisoned.
I have a theory about this, and people may disagree with it, and even some people in the U.S. government disagree with me about this. Mark's case is especially, so it's a poster child for what how we should not act as a nation, but also a reminder to everyone when you go to these places, you have to be careful because you never know when the Chinese will do something. Remember, Mark was picked up, he's a man in his 50s now. He was on his way through China. He had done, he was not heading to China on a trip, but he wanted to go to China on his way back home from a trip to the Asia region to buy building materials and furniture to open a company he wanted to have back home in Texas. So this guy, he's an entrepreneurial fellow, he's a businessman. Mm-hmm. He's a very gifted person too, he's an artist, and also happens to be a patriotic American who felt, hey, I want to open up a company back home, and I'm on the way home, I'm going to buy a container of stuff to get my business going. Mm-hmm. And he happened to just connect with the wrong people, took a cab ride. The cab was pulled over. Apparently some of the people in that cab were wanted by the police for something. They found Mark. Mark had a blue passport. And since then, we've been struggling to get him out. And I've not been working on that case for 10 years. A colleague of mine in the U.S. government came to me about 2 years ago and said, hey, can you help somebody out? And I said, no, I have too many people right now. I can't take any more cases. And of course, I spoke to his mom, Catherine, and how could I not take the case? By this time, the working group that we just spoke about, the UN group, had already issued an opinion finding that there wasn't a lawful detention. And we did in this rebuilding of the coalition was to raise awareness here in the state. So we have focused on, yes, we talked to the Chinese indirectly, that we put pressure on the U.S. government. Why haven't you brought this guy home? And to the credit of champions in the Senate, like Ted Cruz, who's been a champion on this, Ted Cruz picked this up as soon as we went to his office with this. He said, wait a minute, it's a Texan in my state. They move really fast. Two congressional resolutions, one in the House, one in the Senate, were passed. And the case has been raised at the highest levels, according to the U.S. government, by the president, by our ambassador to China, Ambassador Burns. Ambassador Burns has met with Mark three times, I believe.
Wow.
First time Mark ever came into contact face-to-face with a senior-ranking U.S. official since he was locked up.
Wow.
That's wrong, by the way.
How many years?
10.
Now? Jason, oh,
11, it's 11, but it took 10 to get somebody in there.
Wow. So, does he have any communication with his mother, with his family at all?
Now we do. It's policed. It's very, look, they went after Mark because they want Mark, the Chinese want Mark for reasons that we do not know. They want to maybe swap him out for somebody else that the Chinese want from here. They have asked him to sign confessions. He has refused. They have torn up his Bible. He starts writing or drawing pictures about Jesus Christ and Mary. They crushed his rosary. He founds another one, built a finger rosary. So Mark is a remarkable fellow. He's a Renaissance man. And I think once he gets out, he will see how many people have not forgotten about him. But he's also been held in some pretty horrible conditions without contact with his mom for years and years and years. It shouldn't take lawyers in Washington, D.C. and Congress for the U.S. government to do their job. But this happens more than... So this is kind of a warning and a reminder to folks. If you're going to go to a rough country, do not expect your country to come for you.
Be aware.
Be aware and prepare. In fact, take precautions if you have to. Take out insurance. Do whatever you have to do to make sure that you have all the resources in place when you go to a place like that. The odds of you being picked up in communist China, probably not that high. But if the Chinese want to pick up people because they think they can use them as leverage, they will. And at Mark's prison alone, the new place that we finally were able to move him over to, there's about 12 more Americans in there.
Wow.
Now, I'm not saying they're all unlawfully detained.
Right.
But they're probably not being treated very well. So it's just a reminder that you have to be careful where you go. Mark's case has, you know, as far as faith component, Bishop Strickland, by the way, visited with Catherine in Texas a few weeks ago, and it was a great visit. He prayed with her. Mel Gibson did something for Catherine last year. He did a mass for her over at that place he has in California, and he did a video for her in support. So the Catholic community has kind of galvanized a little bit slowly around the case, which they didn't even know about it. So anybody listening to this, please pray for Mark Sweden. Please pray for all these men and women and their families, because this is a tough time. But it's getting closer, and I hope that this year will be the year Mark gets home. But we're not sure, because
These things, Jason, usually result, especially in these oppressive countries, do they usually result in some kind of exchange? You mentioned it. Yeah. I mean, usually there's a negotiation. And, you know, for you, how long did it take you to kind of figure out that when you're working these cases, behind the scenes, the government may be withholding certain elements of the case, you know, from you? Has that been your experience?
That's a challenge in all these cases. In fact, it's one of the more challenging aspects of working on these cases is you have to be comfortable with the gray and the unknown, because you have you're sandwiched between the U.S. government, China, or another third country, and there's information that they will not share with you. You'll never get full information. So it takes a high level of trust also to work with the American government, because sometimes they're the adversary. Sometimes they're not the adversary. Sometimes they'll tell me stuff like, hey, Jason, you're kind of quick on the trigger. Why did you say that? Well, maybe you deserve it, because maybe a man who's locked up for 11 years should not be locked up for 11 years. And if you don't share with the family what you do or you don't do, what do you expect the family to do? Now, a majority of these cases, you will never hear about them, because a majority of them do get resolved, thankfully, quietly, quickly. But by the time they go public like this, and we recommend families do not wait, that is in conflict with what the U.S. government recommends, that they'll tell you, don't say anything. There is a space at the very beginning where maybe being quiet makes sense. But when I get the cases, usually, I wish I had them at the very beginning, and sometimes I do get them at the very beginning. But when I usually see them, it's cases like these, where it's been years and nothing's happened. And you have to speak up. And you also have to be careful what you say. And I think when you deal with the adversarial government, why we sometimes like to use mechanisms like that UN body is because it neutralizes a little bit the rhetoric. But nothing beats face-to-face, and nothing beats confidence building that way. But you're always going to have a certain level of gray in this space, and we have to be comfortable with it, which is frustrating as a lawyer, right? Because we want to have the facts. We believe in rules. We believe if you follow the rules and you have to produce something, you produce it. But that's not the case in this scenario.
Not the real world.
and you're dealing, by the way, Bill, with several different legal regimes. You're dealing with U.S. law, Chinese law, in China case, and international norms and standards. So you got to go through all that bramble to figure out, okay, what is going to be useful to ultimately get our client out of that predicament. And you have to rely on a big team of wonderful people we work with, retired FBI, retired folks in the intelligence community, State Department officials, law enforcement, priests, religious. We reach out to people who are interested and want to help and lend their expert, doctors even. We work with physicians that come and they will take a look at a medical record for somebody that is held in a place where we can get medical records out from, and they'll look at the medical record. We'll look at psychological profiles. And so we try and prepare the families for certain things, and that's kind of a gap that we fill. And we work with other a lot of great NGOs out there doing some good work there in this space. Not many, where there's a support system to kind of help the families through that. But my goal is to focus on the client, what the Americans are doing or not doing, and of course what the adversarial government's doing or not doing, to make sure that we can get him or her out of there fast, unconditionally if possible. Paying money and ransom, it happens. I think that's a bad approach. But you have to have all options on the table, no matter what they are, because you're trying to save a life. So
I can't tell you how much I appreciate, I guess I could say, and celebrate the work that you do. I mean, Jason, you could have become an injury. You know, you could have been on TV every morning, you know, telling people how much money you can get them. instead of doing the work that you do. So for all those people out there that think that, you know, lawyers are kind of like bottom feeders, that's absolutely...
There comes the lawyer joke. I was waiting for a lawyer joke. It hadn't happened yet. All right, Bill, good.
You know, let me ask you, Jason, there any country in the world...
I love lawyer jokes, by the way.
Is there any country in the world that is... considered, I know Switzerland was always considered like this neutral country or whatever. Is there any nation in the world that really is a good go-between between the United States and some
question.
Of these? Is there
question.
Anybody left? Because I've heard that Switzerland isn't necessarily what it used to be in that role.
Well, that's a great question. I think it depends on the country. Although there is an effort underway that started during the Trump administration, that the Biden administration has continued this. This is a very bipartisan issue. We disagree about certain technique, maybe. Mm-hmm. But on the big picture, the policy, there is agreement that we need a better way. So it depends on the country that the person is held in. There are some countries, like in the case of Iran, where maybe we can go through Germany to do certain things, or even some of the more colorful characters in the Gulf region. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say who they are because I think they're bad countries anyhow. But sometimes you got to deal with bad countries to get to a good solution.
Yep.
But there's also an effort underway to try and create a global response, especially through the Anglosphere. You know, I'm talking about the U.S., U.K., Canada, New Zealand, Australia,
maybe.
So the Five Eyes, basically, to come up with a NATO Article 5-like approach. Where if you touch a U.S. national from any of these countries, there will be a collective response to come to the aid of that person and use that network. Because each of those countries in the Anglosphere has a unique pivot or unique access that maybe the U.S. doesn't have to deal with certain powers. Canada has taken a lead role to see if this process can work with some country. Then Secretary Blinken gave a talk about that recently. Some of this started again during President Trump. But we're hopeful this will work. I think we need something like that. I think this should not be something you read about every day in the paper. Unfortunately, we created an organization within the State Department that I feel should have been left a little more low-key. The less we keep this out of the TV, the better.
Yes.
We don't want the bad actors thinking that we're incentivizing a market for Americans.
Yeah.
So I think we have some work to do there to improve that. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, Bill, the whole issue of the whole international system. That's broken. So we can't go to the UN for this. Mm-hmm. They can't. Although the UN has a platform that maybe we can use for talking to people.
Yes.
It has some utility there.
Right.
And that group.
That could open doors.
That
could
open doors, right? And we also, by the way, work with a lot of non-state actors like the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. I have over time worked through the Catholic Church to do a lot of good. And there have been some cases that we have resolved with the help of the Holy See. Mm-hmm. I can't get into them.
Right.
But one of the cases with Iran, believe it or not,
was through
the Holy See was very helpful.
Wow. Wow.
And I can't say if it was the Holy Father or not, but I can say the Holy Father was involved. And there was some good outcomes. So we were able to find this menu of so many good people out there, but there's some work to do. There's still some work to do. Yeah.
Do you find it difficult to recruit lawyers to join your effort? I mean, because it's very complicated work. But at the same time, you have to have some devotion to this whole thing and be willing really to advocate for people that are in very difficult circumstances. Is it hard to find people that are willing to participate?
We want to be able to, meaning we, GLA and me personally, want to train a new generation of lawyer advocates that do this sort of work, partly because it's not something that there's not a pool of lawyers that do this. So we have been talking to law schools to see who wants to do this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it also, there's funding struggles because a lot of these young lawyers,
well, there you go.
This is not an area of law that you're going to become a multimillionaire.
Right.
You can't come to it with that mindset.
Most of them come out of law school with a lot of debt.
But so there's a lot of young lawyers that want to do this sort of thing, but we tell them before you come to us, you have to go out there for now and spend 2 years practicing something, preferably litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you still have a calling to do this, if you still think it's your vocation to dedicate your life to this, then let's talk and we'll figure out a way to do it. So,
Do other countries engage in this kind of activity? I would assume, Jason, that other countries have organizations like yours and an American organization. Do you encounter that at all?
You'd be surprised, Bill. There are some, but they're not as many as we need. Mm. And I think eventually, through platforms like these and reaching out to people and talking more about this, we will find other people who want to do this. We are talking for something like this happening in Australia. We've been talking with a former hostage in Iran who she's very active, Dr. Kylie Moore Gilbert, who's starting her own. She was a hostage in Iran. Mm. She's a college professor. She is starting a movement and a group out there, mm. not of lawyers, but academics, but lawyers may get involved with her. And there's other groups, Hostage Aid Worldwide, based in D.C., former hostages that are doing some work too. So there's not a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But as far as the lawyers go, I think there's a lot of good people out there that want to do this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm quite sure they're probably
they're there. We just want to be able to have them captive audiences. This can't be a part-time pro bono advocation. Yeah. We believe in paying them for what they mm-hmm. do mm-hmm. so they can focus on this good work.
You know, I'm sure that our listeners are kind of fascinated with this conversation, as I am. And, I was aware that there are individuals who do advocate for people unlawfully incarcerated in foreign countries. But what's true is that we as Catholics really need to be praying for you and for your organization. What would be the best way for us to do that? To pray for the individuals, for the lawyers, for all involved, is that what you would suggest?
Just pray for all involved, for all unlawfully imprisoned persons here and around the world, and for hostages. I think just keep those prayers coming. That's what we really need.
Well, Jason, I really want to thank you for joining. I hope that we can have a future conversation.
Of course, yeah.
Maybe we can get into some other cases or what have you, but very thankful for your willingness to come and spend time with us and inform us about your organization, the work that you do, and hopefully that we can continue to pray and support however we can. And I'll also remind people that they need to be careful when they go to a foreign country. Not that we're trying to scare them.
Just do your due diligence.
Just do your due diligence and be wise and be prayerful and obey the laws when you get there, you could say, right? Well, Jason, thank you so much. Let's do this again.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you to Divine Mercy Catholic Radio for having us on.
And thank you for listening to Divine Mercy Radio, Melbourne, Vero Beach.